This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Do you know anyone who has contracted COVID-19 in the last 2 or 3 weeks? The data suggests you probably do. Highly contagious Omicron subvariants spread rapidly. Deaths due to COVID-19 remain low, but hospitalizations are up more than 100% since the beginning of April, and positivity rates in the Commonwealth have climbed to about 5%, which is up from 2%. At the beginning of the month. That runs counter to earlier expectations that perhaps, as spring emerged, cases would subside, masks could come off of those who were still wearing them, and we might have some months that truly did feel like we had exited the pandemic stage of this virus. On top of all that, Moderna asked the FDA to authorize COVID vaccine shots for children under 5, with an efficacy rate of 51% for kids under 2, but 37%. For kids ages 2 to 5. So it's a lot, and we have questions. Joining us to answer them, Dr. Benjamin Linus, an infectious disease specialist at Boston Medical Center, professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. Dr. Linus, welcome back.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. I do want to start with the question of vaccines, this Moderna proposal for younger children. It's one step closer to emergency use authorization. It's got to be a big sigh of relief for many parents out there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really exciting news, and I hope it moves forward quickly. I know that for my colleagues and friends who have under fives, it's been a really challenging time, especially as, you know, most of society is trying to move forward and come to new grips with this pandemic. Those who have under fives at home who are still unvaccinated are really feeling themselves left behind and sort of isolated. So it'll be wonderful to get this tool out and available to everyone who needs it.
So I remember in the early days, Dr. Linus, the threshold kind of in the public conversations about an effective vaccine was above 50%. Of course, the early ones came for emergency use authorization. They were quite high. Here we see 37% preventing infections in 2 to 5 year olds. But I know we also, there's a difference that we understand now between how infectious these variants are and whether or not one gets severe illness or death. So how do you want us to think about these efficacy numbers?
Yeah, it's really challenging, especially with the pediatric vaccine, because I would also point out that, as we now know, it's these age groups are actually at the least personal risk of having severe COVID. There is severe COVID in children. Children have tragically died of SARS-CoV-2 infection, but in general, this is the part of our population, thank goodness, that's at the least personal risk of severe COVID. And so there's been really, part of what's driving this debate at the FDA is there's a big ethical debate between folks that it's really considered not ethical to give somebody a vaccine or a treatment on behalf of benefit to a different person. And if the right, there's one argument to be made that if our children are the least likely to get sick with severe COVID, and if there are potential adverse effects of any treatment or vaccine, then perhaps we shouldn't be giving the vaccine to the people who are at the least risk in exchange, you know, to give benefits to everybody else.
So I really, I want to stop you there because that is something that I don't believe I've ever heard one of our specialists point out to us before. So I want to make sure I grasp it and listeners really hear you. The issue is the ethics of asking somebody to take a vaccine to protect someone else versus what it would do in your own body. Am I understanding you?
That's correct. That right, in general, there's an ethical principle that everybody is an agent to him or herself. Everyone has value as a human, and that you never treat a person as a vehicle to benefit a different person without having some benefit to the individual. I'm not endorsing that argument. I'm just pointing it out. I mean, that is part of this debate. I think it's important that everyone hears that so that they can form their own opinions. However, what I would point out and what I do point out to my colleagues who make that argument is that it's a very narrow-minded focus on death as the only potential bad outcome of COVID. And that if a vaccine is able to help keep our kids in school, help keep their parents at work, help maintain their normal life flows, and hopefully decrease the need for mitigation, at least in all places and at all times, those are all really important benefits to kids. And I think that if you net in all of those benefits and don't keep a single-minded eye on hospitalizations and death, then in my mind, clearly the potential benefits of a pediatric vaccine far outweigh the risks and that we should go forward. I think the numbers you cited are somewhat disappointing, of course. And I think that's been a challenge. And I think that's also part of what's making this debate a contentious one and what's making this take so long. At this point, I would propose that you know, we should take the benefits that we can get. And that even a 37% benefit is not zero, it's 37%. And we need to be using every tool that we can in our tool chest to mitigate this pandemic. Because as you pointed out at the top of the segment, cases are on the rise again. We aren't going to have the wonderful moment that we all fantasized about when somebody sounds the bell and the pandemic is over and everyone runs into the streets and celebrates the way we did at the end of World War II. It's not coming. We're never going to see that time. We're going to have to learn to live with this virus in its various forms. And every tool that we have available is important right now.
So we're talking with Dr. Benjamin Linus, who's an infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center, in Ask the Doc here. I want to just two more things on this, Dr. Linus.
Sure.
You made reference to the fact that there is data showing that younger children with certain, as I understand it, Omicron subvariants have seen more hospitalizations, more severe illness than previously. I mean, that can be very scary. So what mm-hmm. do you make of that? How should people understand what we do and don't know from the data?
Sure. I mean, I think that can be very scary, and it's hard to think numerically and sort of mathematically, rationally around our children. I completely identify. I have three children myself and feel the same way. There are some signals that perhaps the new variants are causing more severe cases in kids, but it can actually be really difficult to tell, because it's also clearly true that the number of just general infections is higher with the Omicron variant. And also with home testing, we're not aware of all of the cases. So although we're seeing hospitalizations go upward and some more severe hospitalizations, it's not clear if that means that the virus itself is causing more severe cases, or if it's that the virus is just generally causing more cases.
Because we don't know fully the compared to what, because we
exactly.
don't really have a sense for how many cases there are out there.
Exactly. And some would say, whatever, it's still more deaths amongst children. That's bad, no matter what the mechanism. And I agree. But if you're looking at your own child who has the infection and trying to decide if you should be scared that this has become a more serious infection, that's not clear. I don't think that we know that yet. And so the good news is that even if it is a relative increase, we're still looking at very low rates of very low risk of death and serious infection amongst pediatric age groups. And that really should give parents some sense of relief or help them to relax a little bit.
All right. And last quick thing on vaccines. Are we comparing apples to apples? So we have, you know, effectiveness against transmission here, and we're talking about 37% mm-hmm. for a certain mm-hmm. age range. But we're also talking about a variant that was a kind of transmissible that didn't exist when we were doing trials for Moderna or Pfizer in the early stages. Is that correct?
That's correct. And so in that sense, I suppose you could say it's not apples to apples. It's not fair. It's a different variant. And so we're comparing a more infectious variant to an older variant. But that's our reality. Those are the apples that we have. And so those are the infections that we're trying to stop now. And I'm sure that some of the decreased efficacy towards transmission amongst pediatric age groups, some of that decrease does reflect the Omicron variant. You know, and I would point out, in the adult age group, people have seen the immunity wanes, right? There might be slightly less vaccine efficacy towards Omicron, but all of those numbers really focus on transmission, right? They're not focusing on severe disease. The vaccines remain very effective on keeping you safe. And that's how we started this pandemic. Back when we were thinking about a 50% efficacy vaccine, we were imagining the vaccines as preventing deaths, not necessarily preventing cases. So the initial vaccines were just so great and such a grand slam, I think, that they sort of shifted the goalpost. And now everyone's expecting a vaccine to end all transmission. And unfortunately, the vaccines can't end all transmission.
It's just but not if they where can, we are.
Right. But if they can cut it in half and prevent everyone from getting severely ill, that's really powerful. Those are the tools that we need to try to move into a post-acute pandemic.
So we asked listeners through our Radio Boston texting group what questions they had. We got this question from Bill in Cambridge. He asks, quote, "Since masks have come off, four family members have come down with COVID. Three of four in my daughter's household, including 9 and 12-year-old grandkids, and my brother. I had dinner with him 2 days before learning he tested positive. Five people attended the dinner, and so far none have tested positive, but I still stayed away from the health club for 5 to 6 days and wore masks in public places to protect others. Did we do the right thing?" End quote. And let me just say, we would like other listeners to join this texting club. We'd like to hear from you. You can text the word BOSTON to 617 7660382. That's the word Boston to 617-766-0382. So your response to Bill, Dr. Linus?
So I'm trying to remember all the details, but I think the bill is doing the right thing. And I can tell you what my family is doing. So first I'll say to folks, a very common question that I get, and it's become one of my favorite phrases of the pandemic, is that a contact of a contact is not a thing. So if you know someone who's a close contact that, right, who you've had exposure to, but that person is not infected, they're just a close contact, that's actually not a thing. Until that person is infected, you're actually not a close contact. I think Bill was giving us some details of being at a meal where there were infected people potentially, and he is a close contact. So if you've been indoors with someone without a mask for more than 15 minutes in close proximity and they're infected, then you are a close contact. At that point, the appropriate thing to do would be, if possible, to test yourself. I know folks are testing every day. My kids were a close contact a couple weeks ago, and we tested about every other day for 5 days. And importantly, too, is it is appropriate then to wear masks when you're going out in public and indoor spaces. If it's possible to do things like avoid the health club, I would do that out of courtesy. I think a nice thing to ask yourself is, what would I want from someone else if I knew someone else were a close contact? What behaviors might I ask of them? And then I should participate in the same behaviors myself. So sometimes you can't avoid mass gatherings. If there's something very important professionally or personally, and you're a close contact, then it's important to mask. And if you can, to test before you go.
So last question on the testing. You said, you know, you thought, so Bill was at dinner with somebody 2 days before they tested positive, as I understand it. Here's my question. Home tests. We hear anecdotal stories. I've had some in my own family circle of people testing positive on a rapid antigen test and then told that their infectiousness could date for 2 days before that. So can you clarify that general question about rapid antigen tests?
Sure. So in general, any test, PCR or rapid antigen, your infectious period can begin 48 hours before you test positive. So that's generally true. Rapid antigen tests also then have this sort of extra issue that I think many people have probably heard stories of folks who are symptomatic and test negative for a couple of days before they finally test positive on the rapid antigen. So it's possible that the rapid antigens are a little less sensitive, a little less likely to find infection in those first 2 days of infection. So both those things are at play here that make it possible and even likely that those people at dinner were infectious at dinner, who then tested positive 48 hours later.
So the key thing is, if you are showing symptoms, you got to act like you've got it.
Yes. If you are showing symptoms, you need to act like you have COVID, which means wearing a mask. I mean, if you actually test positive, I would say you need to stay home. I don't think you need to stay home just because you have a runny nose. All of us, it's spring, we have allergies. But if you have symptoms, even if you're testing negative, it's important to wear masks and to be thoughtful about that, because that first negative test does not rule out COVID infection.
All right. That is Dr. Benjamin Linus, infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center, professor of epidemiology, at Boston University School of Medicine. Always great to have you. Thanks, Dr. Linus.
It was wonderful to be here. Have a good day. Thanks.
You too. Thanks.